I remember as a child, long before video games and the web, threading film strips into the dinky projector in the school library and peering into them, turning the knob that advanced the frame at the sound of a beep. I don't remember anymore what they looked like, what they were about, but I remember the smell of the library and the way the beep made me jump every time. I'm flying now, that golden feeling as if I could run right into the air, and I'm invincible. Nothing can stop me. Nothing can stop me. Nothing, 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 nothing.
Evening the same day. Henry is 28 and 33. Claire is 20. We're on our way to the Violent Femmes concert at the Aragon Ballroom. After some reluctance on Henry's part, which I don't understand because he loves Les Femmes, we are cruising uptown in search of parking. I loop around and around, past the green mill, the bars, the dimly lit apartment buildings, and the laundromats that look like stage sets. I finally park on Argyle, and we walk shivering down the glassy, broken sidewalks. Henry walks fast, and I am always a little out of breath when we walk together. I've noticed that he makes an effort to match my pace now. I pull off my glove and put my hand in his coat pocket, and he puts his arm around my shoulder. I'm excited, because Henry and I have never gone dancing before, and I love the Aragon in all its decaying faux Spanish splendor. My grandma Megram used to tell me about dancing to the big bands here in the 30s, when everything was new and lovely, and there weren't people shooting up in the balconies and lakes of piss in the men's room. But c'est la vie. Times change, and we are here. We stand in line for a few minutes. Henry seems tense, on guard. He holds my hand but stares out over the crowd. I take the opportunity to look at him. Henry is beautiful. His hair is shoulder length, combed back, black and sleek. He's cat-like, thin, exuding restlessness and physicality. He looks like he might bite. Henry is wearing a black overcoat and a white cotton shirt with French cuffs which dangle undone below his coat sleeves. A lovely, acid green silk tie, which he has loosened just enough so that I can see the muscles in his neck. Black jeans and black high-top sneakers. Henry gathers my hair together and wraps it around his wrist. For a moment I am his prisoner, and then the line moves forward and he lets me go. We are ticketed and flow with masses of people into the building. The Aragon has numerous long hallways and alcoves and balconies that wrap around the main hall and are ideal for getting lost and for hiding. Henry and I go up to a balcony close to the stage and sit at a tiny table. We take off our coats. Henry is staring at me.
"You look lovely. That's a great dress. I can't believe you can dance in it."
My dress is skin-tight lilac blue silk, but it stretches enough to move in. I tried it out this afternoon in front of a mirror, and it was fine. The thing that worries me is my hair. Because of the dry winter air, there seems to be twice as much of it as usual. I start to braid it, and Henry stops me.
"Don't, please. I want to look at you with it down."
The opening act begins its set. We listen patiently. Everyone is milling around, talking, smoking. There are no seats on the main floor. The noise is phenomenal. Henry leans over and yells in my ear, "Do you want something to drink?"
"Just a Coke."
He goes off to the bar. I rest my arms on the railing of the balcony and watch the crowd. Girls in vintage dresses, girls in combat gear, boys with mohawks, boys in flannel shirts, people of both sexes in t-shirts and jeans, college kids and 20-somethings, with a few old folks scattered in. Henry is gone for a long time. The warm-up band finishes to scattered applause, and roadies begin removing the band's equipment and bringing on a more or less identical bunch of instruments. Eventually I get tired of waiting, and abandoning our table and coats, I force my way through the dense pack of people on the balcony, down the stairs and into the long, dim hallway where the bar is. Henry's not there. I move slowly through the halls and alcoves, looking but trying not to look like I'm looking. I spot him at the end of a hallway. He is standing so close to the woman that at first I think they are embracing. She has her back to the wall, and Henry leans over her with his hand braced against the wall above her shoulder. The intimacy of their pose takes my breath. She is blonde and beautiful in a very German way, tall and dramatic. As I get closer, I realize that they aren't kissing, they are fighting. Henry is using his free hand to emphasize whatever it is he is yelling at this woman. Suddenly, her impassive face breaks into anger, almost tears. She screams something back at him. Henry steps back and throws up his hands. I hear the last of it as he walks away.
I can't, Ingrid, I just can't, I'm sorry.
Henry! She is running after him when they both see me, standing quite still in the middle of the corridor. Henry is grim as he takes my arm and we walk quickly to the stairs. 3 steps up I turn and see her standing, watching us, her arms at her sides, helpless and intense. Henry glances back and we turn and continue up the stairs. We find our table, which miraculously is still free and still boasts our coats. The lights are going down and Henry raises his voice over the noise of the crowd.
I'm sorry, I never made it as far as the bar and I ran into Ingrid.
Who is Ingrid? I think of myself, standing in Henry's bathroom with a lipstick in my hand, and I need to know, but blackness descends and the violent femmes take the stage. Gordon Gano stands at the microphone, glaring at us all, and menacing chords ring out, and he leans forward and intones the opening lines of Blister in the Sun, and we're off and running. Henry and I sit and listen, and then he leans over to me and shouts, "Do you want to leave?" The dance floor is a roiling mass of slamming humanity.
"I want to dance!"
Henry looks relieved.
"Great! Yes, come on!"
He strips off his tie and shoves it in his overcoat pocket. We wend our way back downstairs and enter the main hall. I see Charisse and Gomez dancing more or less together. Charisse is oblivious and frenzied. Gomez is barely moving, a cigarette absolutely level between his lips. He sees me and gives me a little wave. Moving into the crowd is like wading in Lake Michigan. We are taken in and buoyed along, floating toward the stage. The crowd is roaring, add it up, and the femmes respond by attacking their instruments with insane vigor. Henry is moving, vibrating with the bass line. We are just outside the mosh pit, dancers slamming against each other at high velocity on one side, and on the other side, dancers shaking their hips, flailing their arms, stepping to the music. We dance. The music runs through me, waves of sound that grab me by the spine, that move my feet, my hips, my shoulders, without consulting my brain. Beautiful girl, love your dress, high school smile. Oh, yes, where she is now, I can only guess. I open my eyes and see Henry watching me while he dances. When I raise my arms, he grasps me around the waist and I leap up. I have a panoramic view of the dance floor for a mighty eternity. Someone waves at me, but before I can see who it is, Henry sets me down again. We dance touching. We dance apart. How can I explain personal pain? Sweat is streaming down me. Henry shakes his head and his hair makes a black blur and his sweat is all over me. The music is goading, mocking. I ain't had much to live for. I ain't had much to live for. I ain't had much to live for. We throw ourselves at it. My body is elastic, my legs are numb, and a sensation of white heat travels from my crotch to the top of my head. My hair is damp ropes that cling to my arms and neck and face and back. The music crashes into a wall and stops. My heart is pounding. I place my hand on Henry's chest, and I'm surprised that his seems only slightly quickened. Slightly later, I walk into the ladies' room and see Ingrid sitting on a sink, crying. A small black woman with beautiful long dreads is standing in front of her, speaking softly and stroking her hair. The sound of Ingrid's sobs echoes off the dank yellow tile. I start to back out of the room, and my movement attracts their attention. They look at me. Ingrid is a mess. All her Teutonic cool is gone. Her face is red and puffy. Her makeup is in streaks. She stares at me, bleak and drained. The black woman walks over to me. She is fine and delicate and dark and sad. She stands close and speaks quietly. "Sister," she says. "What's your name?" I hesitate. "Claire," I finally say.
She looks back at Ingrid. Claire, a word to the wise. You are mixing in where you're not wanted. Henry, he's bad news. But he's Ingrid's bad news, and you be a fool to mess with him. You hear what I'm saying?
I don't want to know, but I can't help myself. What are you talking about?
They were going to get married. Then Henry, he breaks it off, tells Ingrid he's sorry, never mind, just forget it. I say she's better off without him, but she don't listen. He treats her bad, drinks like they ain't making it no more, disappears for days and then comes around like nothing happened, sleeps with anything that stands still long enough. That's Henry. When he makes you moan and cry, don't say nobody never told you.
She turns abruptly and walks back to Ingrid, who is still staring at me, who is looking at me with unconditional despair. I must be gaping at them. I'm sorry, I say, and I flee. I wander the halls and finally find an alcove that's empty, except for a young goth girl passed out on a vinyl couch with a burning cigarette between her fingers. I take it from her and stub it out on the filthy tile. I sit on the arm of the couch, and the music vibrates through my tailbone up my spine. I can feel it in my teeth. I still need to pee, and my head hurts. I want to cry. I don't understand what just happened. That is, I understand, but I don't know what I should do about it. I don't know if I should just forget it, or get upset at Henry and demand an explanation, or what. What did I expect? I wish I could send a postcard into the past. To this cad Henry, who I don't know. Do nothing. Wait for me. Wish you were here.
Henry sticks his head around the corner. There you are. I thought I'd lost you.
Short hair. Henry has either gotten his hair cut in the last half hour, or I'm looking at my favorite chrono-displaced person. I jump up and fling myself at him.
Ooh, hey, glad to see you too.
I've missed you. Now I am crying.
You've been with me almost nonstop for weeks.
I know, but you're not you yet. I mean, you're different. Damn!
I lean against the wall and Henry presses against me. We kiss, and then Henry starts licking my face like a mama cat. I try to purr and start laughing.
You asshole, you're trying to distract me from your infamous behavior.
What behavior? I didn't know you existed. I was unhappily dating Ingrid. I met you. I broke up with Ingrid less than 24 hours later. I mean, infidelity isn't retroactive, you know.
She said...
Who said?
The black woman. I mime long hair. Short, big eyes, dreads.
Oh, Lord, that's Celia Atlee. She despises me. She's in love with Ingrid.
She said you were going to marry Ingrid. That you drink all the time, fuck around, and are basically a bad person, and I should run. That's what she said.
Henry is torn between mirth and incredulity. Well, some of that is actually true. I did fuck around a lot, and I certainly have been known to drink rather prodigiously. But we weren't engaged. I would never have been insane enough to marry Ingrid. We were royally miserable together.
But then why?
Claire, very few people meet their soulmates at age 6. So you gotta pass the time somehow. And Ingrid was very patient, overly patient. Willing to put up with odd behavior in the hope that someday I would shape up and marry her martyred ass. And when somebody is that patient, you have to feel grateful, and then you want to hurt them. Does that make any sense?
I guess. I mean, no, not to me, but I don't think that way.
Henry sighs. It's very charming of you to be ignorant of the twisted logic of most relationships. Trust me. When we met, I was wrecked. Blasted and damned, and I am slowly pulling myself together because I can see that you are a human being and I would like to be one too, and I have been trying to do it without you noticing because I still haven't figured out that all pretense is useless between us. But it's a long way from the me you're dealing with in 1991 to me talking to you right now from 1996. You have to work at me. I can't get there alone.
Yes, but it's hard. I'm not used to being the teacher.
Well, whenever you get discouraged, think of all the hours I spent, am spending, with your tiny self. New math and botany, spelling and American history. I mean, you can say nasty things to me in French because I sat there and drilled you on them.
Too true.
Il a les défauts de ses qualités.
But I bet it's easier to teach all that than to teach how to be happy. But you make me happy. It's living up to being happy that's the difficult part.
Henry is playing with my hair, twirling it into little knots.
Listen, Claire, I'm going to return you to the poor imbecile you came in with. I'm sitting upstairs, feeling depressed, and wondering where you are.
I realize that I have forgotten my present Henry in my joy at seeing my once and future Henry, and I am ashamed. I feel an almost maternal longing to go solace the strange boy who is becoming the man before me, the one who kisses me and leaves me with an admonition to be nice. As I walk up the stairs, I see the Henry of my future fling himself into the midst of the slam dancers, and I move as in a dream to find the Henry who is my here and now.
Christmas Eve, 3. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, December 24th, 25th, 26th, 1991. Claire is 20. Henry is 28. It's 8:32 a.m. on the 24th of December, and Henry and I are on our way to Meadowlark House for Christmas. It's a beautiful, clear day. No snow here in Chicago, but 6 inches on the ground in South Haven. Before we left, Henry spent time repacking the car, checking the tires, looking under the hood. I don't think he had the slightest idea what he was looking at. My car is a very cute 1990 white Honda Civic, and I love it. But Henry really hates riding in cars, especially small cars. He's a horrible passenger, holding on to the armrest and braking the whole time we're in transit. He would probably be less afraid if he could be the driver, but for obvious reasons, Henry doesn't have a driver's license. So we are sailing along the Indiana Toll Road on this fine winter day. I'm calm and looking forward to seeing my family, and Henry is a basket case. It doesn't help that he didn't run this morning. I've noticed that Henry needs an incredible amount of physical activity all the time in order to be happy. It's like hanging out with a greyhound. It's different being with Henry in real time. When I was growing up, Henry came and went, and our encounters were concentrated and dramatic and unsettling. Henry had a lot of stuff he wasn't going to tell me, and most of the time he wouldn't let me get anywhere near him, so I always had this intense, unsatisfied feeling. When I finally found him in the present, I thought it would be like that. But in fact, it's so much better in many ways. First and foremost, instead of refusing to touch me at all, Henry is constantly touching me, kissing me, making love to me. I feel as though I have become a different person, one who is bathed in a warm pool of desire. And he tells me things. Anything I ask him about himself, his life, his family, he tells me. With names, places, dates, things that seemed utterly mysterious to me as a child are revealed as perfectly logical. But the best thing of all is that I see him for long stretches of time, hours, days. I know where to find him. He goes to work. He comes home. Sometimes I open my address book just to look at the entry, Henry de Tamble, 714 Dearborn, 11E, Chicago, Illinois, 60610, 312-431-8313. A last name, an address, a phone number. I can call him on the phone. It's a miracle. I feel like Dorothy when her house crash-landed in Oz and the world turned from black and white to color. We're not in Kansas anymore. In fact, we're about to cross into Michigan and there's a rest stop. I pull into the parking lot and we get out and stretch our legs. We head into the building, and there's the maps and brochures for the tourists, and the huge bank of vending machines. Wow, Henry says. He goes over and inspects all the junk food, and then starts reading the brochures. Hey, let's go to Frankenmuth. Christmas, 365 days a year. God, I'd commit harikiri after about an hour of that. Do you have any change? I find a fistful of change in the bottom of my purse, and we gleefully spend it on 2 Cokes, a box of Good and Plenty, and a Hershey bar. We walk back out into the dry, cold air, arm in arm. In the car, we open our Cokes and consume sugar. Henry looks at my watch. Such decadence. It's only 9:15.
Well, in a couple minutes, it'll be 10:15. All right, Michigan's an hour ahead. How surreal.
I look over at him. Everything is surreal. I can't believe you're actually going to meet my family. I've spent so much time hiding you from my family.
Only because I adore you beyond reason am I doing this. I have spent a lot of time avoiding road trips, meeting girls' families, and Christmas. The fact that I am enduring all three at once proves that I love you.
Henry, I turn to him. We kiss.
The kiss starts to evolve into something more when, out of the corner of my eye, I see three prepubescent boys and a large dog standing a few feet away from us, watching with interest.
Henry turns to see what I am looking at, and the boys all grin and give us the thumbs up. They amble off to their parents' van.
By the way, what are the sleeping arrangements at your house?
Oh, dear. Etta called me yesterday about that. I'm in my own room, and you are in the blue room. We're down the hall from each other, with my parents and Alicia in between.
And how committed are we to maintaining this?
I start the car, and we get back on the highway. I don't know, because I've never done this before. Mark just brings his girlfriends downstairs to the rec room and boffs them on the couch in the wee hours, and we all pretend not to notice. If things are difficult, we can always go down to the reading room. I used to hide you down there.
Oh, well. Henry looks out the window for a while. You know, this isn't too bad.
What?
Riding. In a car. On the highway.
Golly. Next you'll be getting on planes.
Never.
Paris, Cairo, London, Kyoto?
No way. I am convinced that I would time travel, and Lord knows if I would be able to get back to something flying 350 miles an hour. I'd end up falling out of the sky a la Icarus.
Seriously?
I'm not planning to find out for sure.
Could you get there by time travel?
Well, here's my theory. Now, this is only a special theory of time travel as performed by Henry de Tamble, and not a general theory of time travel.
Okay.
First of all, I think it's a brain thing. I think it's a lot like epilepsy because it tends to happen when I'm stressed, and there are physical cues like flashing light that can prompt it. And because things like running and sex and meditation tend to help me stay put in the present. Secondly, I have absolutely no conscious control over when or where I go, how long I stay, or when I come back. So time travel tours of the Riviera are very unlikely. Having said that, my subconscious seems to exert tremendous control because I spend a lot of time in my own past visiting events that are interesting or important, and evidently I will be spending enormous amounts of time visiting you, which I am looking forward to immensely. I tend to go to places I've already been in real time, although I do find myself in other more random times and places. I tend to go to the past rather than the future.
You've been to the future? I didn't know you could do that. Henry is looking pleased with himself.
So far, my range is about 50 years in each direction. But I very rarely go to the future, and I don't think I've ever seen much of anything there that I found useful. It's always quite brief. And maybe I just don't know what I'm looking at. It's the past that exerts a lot of pull. In the past, I feel much more solid. Maybe the future itself is less substantial, I don't know. I always feel like I'm breathing thin air out there in the future. That's one of the ways I can tell it is the future. It feels different. It's harder to run there.
Henry says this thoughtfully, and I suddenly have a glimpse of the terror of being in a foreign time and place without clothes, without friends. That's why your feet
are like leather.
The soles of Henry's feet have thick calluses, as though they are trying to become shoes.
I am a beast of the hoof. If anything ever happens to my feet, you might as well shoot me.
We ride on in silence for a while. The road rises and dips. Dead fields of corn stalks flash by. Farmhouses stand washed in the winter sun, each with their vans and horse trailers and American cars lined up in the long driveways. I sigh. Going home is such a mixed experience. I'm dying to see Alicia and Etta, and I'm worried about my mother, and I don't especially feel like dealing with my father and Mark. But I'm curious to see how they deal with Henry, and he with them. I'm proud of the fact that I kept Henry a secret for so long. 14 years. When you're a kid, 14 years is forever. We pass a Walmart, a Dairy Queen, a McDonald's, more cornfields.
an orchard, you pick 'em strawberries, blueberries. In the summer, this road is a long corridor of fruit, grain, and capitalism. But now the fields are dead and dry, and the cars speed along the sunny cold highway, ignoring the beckoning parking lots. I never thought much about South Haven until I moved to Chicago. Our house always seemed like an island, sitting in the unincorporated area to the south, surrounded by the meadow, orchards, woods, farms, and South Haven was just town, as in, let's go to town and get an ice cream. Town was groceries and hardware and Mackenzie's Bakery and the sheet music and records at the Music Emporium, Alicia's favorite store. We used to stand in front of Appleyard's photography studio, making up stories about the brides and toddlers and families, smiling their hideous smiles in the window. We didn't think the library was funny-looking in its faux Greek splendor, nor did we find the cuisine limited and bland, or the movies at the Michigan Theater relentlessly American and mindless. These were opinions I came to later, after I became a denizen of a city, an expatriate anxious to distance herself from the bumpkin ways of her youth. I am suddenly consumed by nostalgia for the little girl who was me, who loved the fields and believed in God, who spent winter days homesick from school reading Nancy Drew and sucking menthol cough drops, who could keep a secret. I glance over at Henry and see that he has fallen asleep. South Haven, 50 miles. 26, 12, 3, 1. Phoenix Road, Blue Star Highway, and then Megrim Lane. I reach over to wake Henry, but he's already awake. He smiles nervously and looks out the window at the endless tunnel of bare winter trees as we hurtle along. And as the gate comes into view, I fumble in the glove compartment for the opener and the gates swing apart and we pass through. The house appears like a pop-up in a book. Henry gasps and starts to laugh. "What?" I say defensively. "I didn't realize it was so huge. How many rooms does this monster have?"
24. I tell him.
Etta is waving at us from the hall window as I pull around the drive and stop near the front door. Her hair is grayer than last time I was here, but her face is pink with pleasure. As we climb out of the car, she's gingerly picking her way down the icy front steps in no coat and her good navy blue dress with the lace collar, carefully balancing her stout figure over her sensible shoes, and I run over to her to take her arm, but she bats me away until she's at the bottom, and then she gives me a hug and a kiss. I breathe in Etta's smell of Noxzema and powder so gladly as Henry stands by waiting.
"And what have we here?"
she says, as though Henry is a small child I have brought along unannounced.
"Etta Milbauer,
Henry de Tamble," I introduce. I see a little O on Henry's face, and I wonder who he thought she was. Etta beams at Henry as we climb the steps. She opens the front door. Henry lowers his voice and asks me, "What about our stuff?" And I tell him that Peter will deal with it. "Where is everyone?" I ask. And Etta says that lunch is in 15 minutes, and we can take off our coats and wash and go right in. She leaves us standing in the hall and retreats to the kitchen. I turn, take off my coat, and hang it in the hall closet. When I turn back to Henry, he is waving at someone. I peer around him and see Nell sticking her broad, snub-nosed face out of the dining room door, grinning. And I run down the hall and give her a big sloppy kiss, and she chuckles at me and says, "Pretty man, monkey girl," and ducks back into the other room before Henry can reach us. "Nell?" he guesses, and I nod. "She's not shy, just busy," I explain. I lead him up the back stairs to the second floor. "You're in here," I tell him, opening the door to the blue bedroom. He glances in and follows me down the hall. "This is my room," I say apprehensively, and Henry slips around me and stands in the middle of the rug, just looking, and when he turns to me, I see that he doesn't recognize anything. Nothing in the room means a thing to him. And the knife of realization sinks in deeper. All the little tokens and souvenirs in this museum of our past are as love letters to an illiterate. Henry picks up a wren's nest. It happens to be the first of all the many bird's nests he gave me over the years, and says, "Nice." I nod,
and open my mouth to tell him. And he puts it back on the shelf and says, "Does that door lock?" And I flip the lock, and we're late for lunch.
I'm almost calm as I follow Claire down the stairs, through the dark, cold hall and into the dining room. Everyone is already eating. The room is low-ceilinged and comfortable in a William Morrissey sort of way. The air is warm from the fire crackling in the small fireplace, and the windows are so frosted over that I can't see out. Claire goes over to a thin woman with pale red hair, who must be her mother, who tilts her head to receive Claire's kiss, who half rises to shake my hand. Claire introduces her to me as my mother, and I call her Mrs. Abshire, and she immediately says, "Oh, but you must call me Lucille, everyone does," and smiles in an exhausted but warm sort of way, as though she is a brilliant sun in some other galaxy. We take our seats across the table from each other. Claire is sitting between Mark and an elderly woman who turns out to be her great-aunt Dulcie. I am sitting between Alicia and a plump, pretty blonde girl who is introduced as Sharon and who seems to be with Mark. Claire's father sits at the head of the table, and my first impression is that he is deeply disturbed by me. Handsome, truculent Mark seems equally unnerved. They've seen me before. I wonder what I was doing that caused them to notice me, remember me, recoil ever so slightly in aversion when Claire introduces me. But Philip Abshire is a lawyer, and master of his features, and within a minute he is affable and smiling, the host, my girlfriend's dad, a balding, middle-aged man with aviator glasses and an athletic body gone soft and paunchy, but strong hands, tennis-playing hands, gray eyes that continue to regard me warily despite the confidential grin. Mark has a harder time concealing his distress, and every time I catch his eye, he looks at his plate. Alicia is not what I expected. She is matter-of-fact and kind, but a little odd, absent. She has Philip's dark hair, like Mark, and Lucille's features, sort of. Alicia looks as though someone had tried to combine Claire and Mark, but had given up and thrown in some Eleanor Roosevelt to fill in the gaps. Philip says something, and Alicia laughs, and suddenly she is lovely. And I turn to her in surprise as she rises from the table. "I've got to go to St. Basil's," she informs me. "I got a rehearsal. Are you coming to church?" I dart a look at Claire, who nods slightly, and I tell Alicia, "Of course." And as everyone sighs with, what, relief? I remember that Christmas is, after all, a Christian holiday, in addition to being my own personal day of atonement. Alicia leaves. I imagine my mother laughing at me, her well-plucked eyebrows raised high at the sight of her half-Jewish son marooned in the midst of Christmas in Goyland, and I mentally shake my finger at her. "You should talk," I tell her. "You married an Episcopalian." I look at my plate, and it's ham, with peas and an effete little salad. I don't eat pork, and I hate peas. "Claire tells us you're a librarian," Philip says. And I admit that this is so. We have a chipper little discussion about the Newberry and people who are Newberry trustees, and also clients of Philip's firm, which apparently is based in Chicago, in which case I am not clear about why Claire's family lives way up here in Michigan. "Summer homes," he tells me. And I remember Claire explaining that her father specializes in wills and trusts. I picture elderly rich people reclining on their private beaches, slathering on sunblock and deciding to cut Junior out of the will, reaching for their cell phones to call Philip. I recollect that Avi, who is first chair to my father's second at the CSO, has a house around here somewhere. I mention this, and everyone's ears perk.
"Do you know him?"
Lucille asks. "Sure. He and my dad sit right next to each other."
"Sit next to each other?"
"Well, you know, first and second violin."
"Your father is a violinist?"
"Yeah." I look at Claire, who is staring at her mother with a "don't embarrass me" expression on her face. And he plays for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra? Yes. Lucille's face is suffused with pink. Now I know where Claire gets her blushes.
Do you think he would listen to Alicia play if we gave him a tape?
I grimly hope that Alicia is very, very good. People are constantly bestowing tapes on Dad. Then I have a better idea. Alicia's a cellist, isn't she?
Yes.
Is she looking for a teacher? Philip interjects, she studies with Frank Wainwright in Kalamazoo. Because I could give the tape to Yoshi Akawa. One of his students just left to take a job in Paris. Yoshi is a great guy and first-chair cello. I know he'll at least listen to the tape. My dad, who doesn't teach, will simply pitch it out. Lucille is effusive. Even Philip seems pleased. Claire looks relieved. Mark eats. Great Aunt Dulcie, pink-haired and tiny, is oblivious to this whole exchange. Perhaps she's deaf? I glance at Sharon, who is sitting on my left and who hasn't said a word. She looks miserable. Philip and Lucille are discussing which tape they should give me, or perhaps Alicia should make a new one. I ask Sharon if this is her first time up here, and she nods. Just as I'm about to ask her another question, Philip asks me what my mother does, and I blink. I give Claire a look that says, "Didn't you tell him anything?" My mother was a singer. She's dead. Claire says quietly, "Henry's mother was Annette Lynn Robinson." She might as well have told them my mom was the Virgin Mary. Philip's face lights up. Lucille makes a little fluttering motion with her hands.
Unbelievable! Fantastic! We have all her recordings!
Und so weiter. But then Lucille says, I met her when I was young. My father took me to hear Madame Butterfly, and he knew someone who took us backstage afterward, and we went to her dressing room, and she was there, and all these flowers, and she had her little boy wife. That was you! I nod, trying to find my voice. Claire says, what did she look like? Mark says, are we going skiing this afternoon? Philip nods. Lucille smiles, lost in memory.
She was so beautiful. She still had the wig on, that long black hair, and she was teasing the little boy with it, tickling him, and he was dancing around. She had such lovely hands, and she was just my height, so slender, and she was Jewish, you know. But I thought she looked more Italian.
Lucille breaks off, and her hand flies to her mouth, and her eyes dart to my plate, which is clean except for a few peas. Are you Jewish? Mark asks pleasantly. I suppose I could be if I wanted, but nobody ever made a point of it. She died when I was 6, and my dad's a lapsed Episcopalian.
You look just like her,
Lucille volunteers, and I thank her. Our plates are removed by Etta, who asks Sharon and me if we drink coffee. We both say yes at the same time, so emphatically that Claire's whole family laughs. Etta gives us a motherly smile, and minutes later she sets steaming cups of coffee in front of us, and I think, that wasn't so bad after all. Everyone talks about skiing and the weather, and we all stand up and Philip and Mark walk into the hall together. I ask Claire if she's going skiing, and she shrugs and asks me if I want to, and I explain that I don't ski and I have no interest in learning. She decides to go anyway after Lucille says that she needs someone to help with her bindings. As we walk up the stairs, I hear Mark say,
"Incredible resemblance,"
and I smile to myself. Later, after everyone has left and the house is quiet, I venture down from my chilly room in search of warmth and more coffee. I walk through the dining room and into the kitchen, and am confronted by an amazing array of glassware, silver, cakes, peeled vegetables, and roasting pans in a kitchen that looks like something you'd see in a 4-star restaurant. In the midst of it all stands Nell with her back to me, singing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and waggling her large hips, waving a baster at a young black girl who points at me mutely. Nell turns around and smiles a huge gap-toothed smile and then says, "What are you doing in my kitchen, Mr. Boyfriend? Well, I was wondering if you have any coffee left." "Left? What do you think? I let coffee sit around all day getting vile? Shoo, son, get out of here. Go sit in the living room and pull on the bell, and I'll make you some fresh coffee. Didn't your mama teach you about coffee?" "Well, actually, my mother wasn't much of a cook," I tell her, venturing closer to the center of the vortex. "Something smells wonderful. What are you making?" "What you're smelling is a Thompson's turkey," Nell says. She opens the oven to show me a monstrous turkey that looks like something that's been in the Great Chicago Fire. It's completely black. "Don't look so dubious, boy. Underneath that crust is the best-eaten turkey on planet Earth." I am willing to believe her. The smell is perfect. "What is a Thompson's turkey?" I ask. And Nell discourses on the miraculous properties of the Thompson's turkey, invented by Morton Thompson, a newspaper man, in the 1930s. Apparently, the production of this marvelous beast involves a great deal of stuffing, basting, and turning. Nell allows me to stay in her kitchen while she makes me coffee and wrangles the turkey out of the oven and wrestles it onto its back, and then artfully drools cider gravy all over it before shoving it back into the chamber. There are 12 lobsters crawling around in a large plastic tub of water by the sink. "Pets?" I tease her, and she replies, "That's your Christmas dinner, son. You want to pick one out? You're not vegetarian, are you?" I assure her that I'm not, that I am a good boy who eats whatever is put in front of him. "You never know it. You're so thin," Nell says. "I'm going to feed you up." "Well, that's why Claire brought me." "Hmm," Nell says, pleased. "All right, then. Now scat, so I can get on here." I take my large mug of fragrant coffee and wend my way to the living room, where there is a huge Christmas tree and a fire. It looks like an ad for Pottery Barn. I settle myself in an orange wing chair by the fire, and I'm riffing through the pile of newspapers when someone says, "Where'd you get the coffee?" And I look up and see Sharon sitting across from me in a blue armchair that exactly matches her sweater. "Hi," I say. "I'm sorry, but that's okay," Sharon says. "I went to the kitchen, but I guess we're supposed to use the bell, wherever that is." We scan the room, and sure enough, there's a bell pull in the corner. "This is so weird," Sharon says. "We've been here since yesterday, and I've been just kind of creeping around, you know? Afraid to use the wrong fork or something." "Where are you from?" "Florida," she laughs. "I never had a white Christmas till I got to Harvard. My dad owns a gas station in Jacksonville. I figured after school I'd go back there, you know, because I don't like the cold, but now I guess I'm stuck." "How come?" Sharon looks surprised. "Didn't they tell you? Mark and I are getting married." I wonder if Claire knows this. It seems like something she would have mentioned. Then I notice the diamond on Sharon's finger. "Congratulations." "I guess. I mean, thank you." Aren't you sure? About getting married?" Sharon actually looks like she's been crying. She's all puffy around the eyes. "Well, I'm pregnant, so..." "Well, it doesn't necessarily follow." "Yeah, it does, if you're Catholic." Sharon sighs and slouches into the chair. I actually know several Catholic girls who have had abortions and weren't struck down by lightning, but apparently Sharon's is a less accommodating faith. "Well, congratulations. When?" "January 11th. She sees my surprise and says, "Oh, the baby?" "April." She makes a face. "I hope it's over spring break, because otherwise I don't see how I'll manage. Not that it matters so much now." "What's your major?"
"Pre-med."
My parents are furious. They're leaning on me to give it up for adoption. "Don't they like Mark?"
They've never even met Mark. It's not that. They're just afraid I won't go to medical school and it will all be a big waste.
The front door opens and the skiers have returned. A gust of cold air makes it all the way across the living room and blows over us. It feels good, and I realize that I'm being roasted like Nell's turkey by the fire here. "What time is dinner?" I ask Sharon.
7, but last night we had drinks in here first. Mark had just told his mom and dad, and they weren't exactly throwing their arms around me. I mean, they were nice, you know. How people can be nice, but be mean at the same time. I mean, you think I got pregnant all by myself, and Mark had nothing to do with it.
I'm glad when Claire comes in. She's wearing a funny peaked green cap with a big tassel hanging off it and an ugly yellow skiing sweater over blue jeans. She's flushed from the cold and smiling. Her hair is wet, and I see as she walks ebulliently across the enormous Persian carpet in her stocking feet toward me that she does belong here. She's not an aberration. She has simply chosen another kind of life. And I'm glad. I stand up and she throws her arms around me, and then just as quickly she turns to Sharon and says,
I just heard congr-